conflict that would give them the leverage to do that. I think one of the things they're trying to leverage through that is an overwhelming focus on the front in Iran to give them cover, to seize Lebanon south of the Litani River.
Already they're up to the they're aiming for the Zahrani north of Litani.
And they're killing, I think they've killed something like 1,300 people. They're trying to transform not only the boundaries, not only the shape of the state of Israel, but establish Israel as the only real regional superpower, displacing Iran. I don't think that will work. I think what we've learned is that, for better or for worse, I will leave Behrouz to describe the cleavages within Iran and how the Islamic Republic relates to its own people. But nevertheless, the Islamic Republic has proven not only its resiliency beyond what Israeli and American war planners had thought, but it's shown that its strategy for defending itself and for inflicting pain on the broader American and Israeli coalition in the Gulf is undisturbed by what Iran and by what the United States and Israel have thrown at it for a month.
And okay, that is a key question. You're a journalist, Spencer, so let's put that question to Behrouz: is what's happening to the population of Iran? Also, is the internet still largely out? How do people communicate with each other, with the outside world? But the rifts, the fissures within the Iranian Republic right now, and where does the resistance stand?
You know, the Iranian society has been quite a vibrant society in the past 40 years. Iranian society has always been engaged in a very meaningful struggle to expand civil liberties, to create space for breathing, simply, and for a space for a struggle for social justice.
You yourself were a part of that.
Of course,
and
you know, and that never ended, and it continued, and people gained a lot of grounds and lost a lot of grounds, and one of the I think one of the most tragic consequences of this war is that this war destroyed that space within which people struggled for this transformation of Iranian society. And I always say that we need to de-link this war from situation of repression in Iran and the question of social justice in Iran, because this war has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the question of, you know, violations of human rights or civil liberties in Iran. It has nothing to do with that at all. And what this war is doing, and I want to pick up on something that you mentioned and Spencer mentioned at the beginning, that this war is normalizing different kind of conversation about how wars are fought, and I think this war began, I think, in Gaza with the Israelis' attempt to basically openly, blatantly, flagrantly violating all rule-based conditions of fighting a war. And this was a genocide openly done and even posted on social media. And the world stood silently, and not only stood silently, but also helped Israel to carry out that genocide. And I think now we witness, and it's not a coincidence, that Trump openly talks about war crimes from the podium at the White House, and no one actually says anything about it, because he's openly advocating war crimes by attacking civilian infrastructure, sources of energy, water salination in Iran. And so I think this is a very, very important point that we should not allow the normalization of that kind of discourse.
Well, before we conclude, Behrouz, I'd like to go to comments made by the anthropologist at Johns Hopkins University, Nargis Bajogli, in her recent piece in Foreign Affairs magazine headlined Iran's Long Game. She wrote, quote, "In the Iran-Iraq war, the loss of commanders had created dangerous vulnerabilities for Tehran. To avoid the same result during a U.S. or Israeli campaign, Over the past four decades, the regime has deliberately decentralized its military command, distributed political authority across regional nodes that can operate autonomously, and cultivated multiple potential successors at every level of the IRGC and the governing establishment. So that's Nargis in foreign affairs. Could you talk about what the implications of that are in terms of regime change?
Regime change, it basically is a shibboleth that Trump is using, and it's totally meaningless at this point. It's very clear that the Islamic Republic has created at least four levels of replacement possibilities. And not only militarily, they have trained and put in place commanders that can take over in the matter of minutes, but also politically, they have given governors of different states full political autonomy in case of the collapse of the central government. They are in the position of making independent decisions to carry on their political responsibilities. So the idea of regime change and the possibility of it is so remote. And I think that has become very clear for Trump administration and for the Israelis, who basically don't have a plan for regime change. They want a plan for a failed state, not a regime change.
I want to ask about another Nargis Mohammadi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. Mm-hmm. I want to ask about Evin, a place you know well. You're on death row in Evin prison. Mm-hmm. Are you afraid that Iran or the U.S. or Israel will bomb Evin, where Nargis and so many other dissidents are?
I think Nargis Mohammadi is not in Evin at this point. They transferred her to a different town. But that's always the fear that I said that this war doesn't have anything to do with the question of social justice and civil liberties in Iran. And people who are inside prison are not basically people this war wants to protect. And these are people who are trying to promote and fight on behalf of social justice and civil liberties. So if they bomb the prison, I think that would be consistent with the way this war has been carried out.
Spencer, 30 seconds.
This war is already lost. I don't know how long it will go on, but Iran has so thoroughly outfoxed the United States that you heard Trump say he is willing to walk away from a conflict he began without reopening the Strait of Hormuz. That is not how winners operate, just to be really frank about it. If the United States leaves the Strait of Hormuz closed or basically throttled in the possession of the Iranians will have reset the terms of the Middle East and quite possibly with spillage effects on the entire global economy. That is a recipe for returning to war, not ending it.
Well, we have so much more to talk about, but we have to end it now. The conversation continues. Spencer Ackerman, Pulitzer Prize-winning, National Magazine Award-winning reporter, will link to your newsletter, Forever Wars. And Behrouz Ghamadi Tabrizi, fellow at the Center for Peace, Culture, and Politics at the CUNY Graduate Center. Latest book, The Long War on Iran, New Events, Old Questions. Everyone should read it. Coming up, Supreme Court justices appear skeptical of President Trump's efforts to end birthright citizenship. Back in 20 seconds.
Here in our home, they killed and roamed in the winter of 26. We'll remember the names of those who died on the streets of his face and his chest. Then we heard the gunshots, and Alex Pretty lay in the snow dead. Their claim was self-defense, sir. Just don't believe your eyes. It's our blood and bones and these whistles and phones against Miller and Norm.
Straight streets of Minneapolis, Bruce Springsteen performing at Democracy Now's 30th anniversary last week at Riverside Church. On Tuesday, Bruce launched his new tour in Minneapolis and from the stage described the Trump administration's corrupt, incompetent, racist, reckless, and treasonous. Just before we went to air this morning, President Trump attacked Bruce Springsteen in social media. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Wednesday on one of the most consequential cases of the year, the constitutionality of President Trump's attempt to end birthright citizenship. On the first day of his second term, Trump signed an executive order declaring children born in the United States to parents without permanent legal status would no longer be granted citizenship automatically. The case has been working its way through the courts. Last July, a federal appeals court in California said the order violates the plain language of the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to, quote, all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, unquote. In 1898, the Supreme Court reaffirmed birthright citizenship. That case was brought by Wong Kim Ark, a Chinese-American man born in San Francisco to Chinese parents. He was barred from re-entering the U.S. despite being a citizen.
Questions from both conservative and liberal members of the court revealed skepticism of the Trump administration's arguments. Cecilia Wang of the ACLU argued against the constitutionality of the court. Speaking to reporters and supporters after leaving the court, she, a birthright citizen herself, said she was confident in their arguments.
I come out of the court today with the thought of my parents and so many of our parents and ancestors who came to this country seeking refuge, seeking new opportunities, and who relied on the rule that we've had in this country for 150 years, that everyone born here is a United States citizen, all alike. And I'm confident that the court is going to turn back this president's effort to radically rewrite our 14th Amendment rule of birthright citizenship. I want to thank the whole team behind me who have brought this case from the very beginning. We have a nation of millions on our side, and we couldn't be more confident about our arguments here. Thank you.
President Trump broke precedent by attending the arguments in person, sitting in the front row before leaving the court early. During a luncheon at the White House afterwards, he criticized the justices.
You can have a case where the person you're suing admits they're guilty. And if you're in front of a Democrat judge, you'll overturn that admittance. Now, it's very unfair. Republicans, judges, and justices, they always want to show that they're independent. I don't care if Trump appointed me. I don't care if he doesn't make any difference to me. I'm voting against him because they want to show their independence. You know, stupid people. So Pam and I were over there with some people. We watched, and actually nobody knew what the hell was going on. Simple subject. It's look at the time. It was passed right at the end of the Civil War. It was for the babies of slaves.
For more, we're joined by two guests. Norman Wong joins us from Washington, D.C., great-grandson of Wong Kim Ark. He gathered with supporters outside the Supreme Court yesterday. Arti Kohli is the executive director of the Asian Law Caucus, co-counsel in the case. She attended oral arguments yesterday, joining us from Oakland, California. Arti, let's begin with you. Talk about how the oral arguments went yesterday. Trump walked out after his side was argued. But the significance of what the justices across the political spectrum asked and where you think this case is headed.
Yeah, I think the oral arguments went really well for our side. As you may know, the Asian Law Caucus is co-counsel in the case with the ACLU. And I thought Cecilia Wang did a phenomenal job. The justices had a lot of questions for General Sauer. And I think it was also pretty notable that President Trump came to the courtroom, it was clearly an attempt to intimidate the justices. But, you know, once he sat down, people were focused on the court and the questions, and there was really, you know, not much attention paid to him. I think the oral arguments went really well. I felt like justices were quite skeptical of General Sauer's arguments.
And Aarti, if you could talk about what specifically Trump is attempting to do, because, of course, there are many levels of birthright citizenship, and what he's trying to do is eradicate unrestricted birthright citizenship, which I understand only Canada and the U.S. Have, at least among developed countries or advanced wealthy countries.
A very simple and clear rule, and it actually has made America what it is, which is a very vibrant and diverse society. And so the current rule is, if you are a child born on American soil and you are a U.S. citizen, and with very limited, narrow exceptions, unless you're born, you're a child of an ambassador or part of a tribal community. So what the executive order does is say, if your parents, at least one parent has to be either a green card holder or a U.S. citizen. So we're talking about students, researchers, undocumented people, H-1Bs, asylum seekers, people who have not yet been granted asylum, temporary protected status, DACA. I mean, we're talking about hundreds and thousands of babies. And for some of them, they would get citizenship through their parents' birthplace, but many would be stateless. So, you know, they would have no documentation and no ability to travel. And, you know, it would be a game changer for not just those children, but for the United States.
Norman Wong, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. Tell us what happened to your great-grandfather, Wong Kim Ark, the Chinese-American whose citizenship was challenged by the U.S. government in 1895.
Well, like Bruce Springsteen, Wong Kim Ark, my great-grandfather was born in the USA, in San Francisco, Chinatown specifically. His parents weren't allowed to become U.S. citizens, but they were allowed to come, man and wife, to America. They were trying to make their dreams here. The parents and Wong Kim Ark left, and they... But he came back as a child to live the American dream, because when he was born here and raised here and left here when he was, I think, about 7, in his soul was really American. His behavior was American. And so he came back as a very young boy, I believe, to work in the United States, in the gold mines, as cook's help. And everything I find out about him says he definitely was born in the USA. And I grew up. I was born in the USA. I was born here. And I believe I thought like the way he must have thought. And that's why he had a sense, not of entitlement, but of a fair play. He had a sense that America was a land of opportunity, and that he could do things that he couldn't do if he was in China as Chinese, because actually the Chinese, in a sense, were a conquered people. The Manchus ran that country and was being carved up by the Europeans, so it was under great, great stress. America provided the opportunity that his parents didn't have here or in China, because they were chased out in 1877 when the Chinatowns were burned down. So he saw America as a safe place and a place of opportunity. I saw that too when I was a child. And I thank people like Bruce Springsteen for singing, standing up for us. In San Francisco, we took his words and used them in our speeches to convey how we felt. And so I appreciate it. Yesterday, we had African Americans who spoke eloquently in front of the Supreme Court in our behalf. And I thank them because we need to stand as Americans together, regardless of color or religion or where we came from, because most all of us, I understand more than 300 million Americans owe their citizenship ultimately to birthright citizenship. Only the indigenous people are the first nation, are not birthright citizenship. They had their original place in our country. And I feel that we haven't always gotten it right with all the people here, but that doesn't mean we should make it worse. We should try to fix what we've done wrong and make amends where we can make amends and try to make this indivisible, one country under God, with life, liberty, and justice for all. I'm sorry if I got the pledge wrong, because it's been many years since I had to say it. But I think we all understood what it meant, even as a child. Thank you.
Artie Coley, as we wrap up, we just have 30 seconds, but the reference to enslaved people, how they fit into the issue of birthright citizenship.
Yes. I mean, we have the 14th Amendment because the government at that time, Lincoln, wanted to make sure that the children of enslaved people were born Americans, and wanted to make it clear to that anybody born on American soil was Americans. And that's how the law has been interpreted for the past 150 years since the amendment was ratified. And that's what Wong Kim Ark decided. And, you know, that court, the Wong Kim Ark court, was not a progressive court. This is a court that decided Plessy v. Ferguson. And they reluctantly affirmed this right. And it's something that all Americans have benefited from since its inception.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll be talking much more about this in the coming weeks. Artie Coley, Executive Director of the Asian Law Caucus, co-counsel in the birth citizenship case, oral arguments heard before the Supreme Court yesterday. And Norman Wong, great-grandson of Wong Kim Ark. Coming up, we look at Israel's new death penalty law, designed only to apply to Palestinians. Back in 20 seconds.
Well, I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind.
Resistance Revival Chorus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israel is facing a global outcry after the Israeli Knesset approved a death penalty law designed to only apply to Palestinians. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel petitioned the country's Supreme Court to strike down the law minutes after it passed, calling it discriminatory by design.
We go now to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Sarit Mikaeli, International Outreach Director at the Israeli Human Rights Group, B'Tselem. Explain what the Knesset just passed, Sarit.
Thank you. It's a privilege being with you, Amy and Narneen. So the Israeli Knesset essentially passed, I'll simplify, a law that applies only to Palestinians, both in Israel's civil courts and in the Israeli military courts that are run in the West Bank. And essentially it means that if Palestinians in these circumstances, in these instances, are found guilty of killing, of murder, with an opposition or an intention that is terroristic in nature, that is opposed, quote unquote, to the state of Israel, then essentially there is a death penalty. There are some differences between the two systems, but the basic discriminatory nature, the basic fact that this will be only applied to Palestinians is across the board, is the same across the board. This shocking, this egregious, draconian law pretends to be somehow based on any sort of, grounded in some sort of objective criteria, but essentially it's basically specifically written to apply only to Palestinians.
So, Sarit, so it's written to apply to Palestinians, though Palestinians aren't specifically named in the law. But could you talk about the fact that Palestinians, unlike Israelis, are already tried in military courts and what that means effectively in terms of their access to justice?
Yes. So, of course, Palestinians who live in the occupied West Bank, under Israeli control, are tried by Israeli military courts where Israel and Israeli soldiers are basically the prosecutors, the judges, and where Israel sets the law. And Israel decides what is right and wrong, what are offenses, and what is legitimate. Palestinians do not take part in any sort of decisions that apply to these military courts. So essentially, it's basically like a military dictatorship that is ruling over Palestinians. And now, with the change in Israel's law, so the new amendment adopted by our parliament, this will mean that if Palestinians are convicted of murder under Israel's terror laws, then there will be a default death penalty attached to them. There is also a possibility under very extenuating and rare circumstances that they will only, quote unquote, face a life sentence, but the default will be a death penalty. This will also be in a very difficult situation for any sort of a way that, to challenge it, because there is no real option for appeal. The execution, which has already been decided, will happen by hanging, will happen in most circumstances within 90 days. So this, of course, does not leave a lot of room for correcting errors or for any sort of attempts to try and get people off of death row. But then there is another system. So this is when Israeli occupation that applies in the West Bank will then basically condemn Palestinians to death for offenses that Israel decided are against Israeli security, terror offenses.
But Sarit, if I could just, before we conclude, we have 30 seconds, Sarit. How are human rights groups going to challenge this legislation?
So I would just want to add one important thing, which is that this law actually enshrines, it makes formal a situation where Israelis and Israel are killing Palestinians with impunity in huge numbers. I mean, for the past 2 years, in our genocide of Gaza, in our vast numbers, the vast numbers of Palestinians who were also killed in the West Bank, these things have happened with impunity, and the new law that will impose a death penalty is simply making this formalized. However, I think there is also the issue of what this means in terms of Israel's culture, Israeli society's dehumanization of Palestinians. I think this is an example, or this is proof of how low our society has sunk.
Sarit Makaeli, we have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us, International Outreach Director at the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Looking for work that fits your schedule and can help make a difference in your community? Statistics Canada is hiring approximately 32,000 people across Canada for the 2026 census. Census jobs offer competitive pay, flexible hours, valuable experience, and the chance to help collect data that shape programs and services in your community. Apply today at census.gc.ca/jobs. A message from the Government of Canada.